coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report.
We have people in the import and particularly in the export world right now that are very frustrated with our level of service.
The problems at the ports take center stage for the State Board of Food and Agriculture meeting. We bring you the details in segment 3 and 4 today. We also have today's news brief, but we start the show with Walnut Wednesday. Taylor Chalstrom talks with Sandro Steinbach, assistant professor at the University of Connecticut, about the impacts of trade wars on the California tree nut industry.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Zandro, a study you co-authored with UC personnel titled 2018 Trade War, Mitigation Payments and California Agriculture found that California ag producers were among the biggest losers of the trade war. Why was that?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to talk about my research with you and your listeners today. As your viewers may know, several trading partners imposed bilateral tariffs against products imported from the United States in response to US tariffs in 2018. In relative terms, the agriculture and food industry was affected more by retaliatory tariffs than any other sector of the economy. We calculated in our study that the average foreign tariff on U.S. agriculture and food products increased from 8.3% to 28.6%, targeting about 910 products and encompassing more than $31.9 billion, which is about 37.1% of agriculture and food exports of the United States. China imposed retaliatory tariffs on almost all agriculture and food products, Canada on processed meats and fruits, vegetables, coffee and whiskey, Mexico on processed fruits and pork, cheese and vegetables, the European Union on processed vegetables and grains, fruit juice, peanut butter and whiskey, and Turkey on tree nuts, rice, some prepared foods, whiskey and tobacco. The impact of retaliatory tariffs was particularly significant for agriculture and food trade with China. U.S. exports of agricultural products to China decreased by 53% between 2017 and 2018, compared to its share of agricultural commodities impacted by the trade war and the losses incurred. California was not a big recipient of MFP payments. We found that California losses during the first year of the trade war, meaning 2018-2019, were about $875.1 million, while MFP 1 and MFP 2 payments amounted to only $96 million and $355.4 million, respectively, for 2018 and 2019.
Okay. And those are obviously some huge losses for California. Why California specifically? You know, were there other states affected even nearly as badly as California?
Sure. California is one of the largest agriculture producers and exporters of the United States, serving customers all over Asia that implemented, in the case of China, significantly new trade barriers with U.S. exporters. That led to significant losses, particularly since California producers actually produce products that are of high value, have high value added, and therefore generate a higher economic value than of products that are produced, for instance, in Midwestern states such as soybean or corn.
Okay. Zandro, a number of different countries took advantage of opened opportunities to capture market share of food and ag products during this trade war. How can the United States recapture these markets under this new administration here?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Let's briefly recap actually what we are talking in terms of number. Retaliatory tariffs have reduced U.S. agriculture exports to China. Just let's talk about China for a minute, because that is the market that is the most significantly affected, by close to $14.4 billion per year, eliminating China as the number one export market for U.S. agriculture. The data indicates that Australia, in terms of almonds, grapes, oranges, and walnuts, Peru, in terms of grapes, Chile, in terms of walnuts and grapes, Egypt in terms of oranges, and Iran in terms of pistachios gained from the Chinese tariffs against the United States. California was the most important exporter of walnuts to China. But with the tariffs taking place, China has shifted to Chile and Australia for imported walnuts. That is what we as economists are actually calling trade diversion. Also, producers of almonds and pistachios substantially increased their export to China. They also lost market share in that growing market. And that is important. China's exports are growing substantially. Demand in most of the emerging economies is growing substantially. Losing market shares in a growing market is the worst that can happen to an exporter, because suppliers, consumers don't forget, basically. In addition, there could be long-lasting consequences for California associated with China looking elsewhere for export suppliers and using this opportunity to diversify its supply chains. Significant efforts need to be made to regain this market share and reposition the United States as a strong player in these emerging economies such as China, where significant demand growth for California is expected for the next decades.
Okay. And in terms of those efforts, what are you speculating is going to happen? Is it going to be more just marketing and advertising efforts in general by the United States, or is it going to be getting into the nitty-gritty of these trade and tariff deals?
Yeah, so as your listeners or viewers may know, there was a phase one deal established between China and the United States in 2019 that supposed to increase exports of the United States to China by 200 billion in 2020 and 2021. So basically to recover the cost that were coming with the trade war. These policies, as we discussed later, didn't really pay off as expected. So at the same time, WTO requirements actually prohibit new policies that would promote exports to these markets. So the only instruments that really exist is to build trust in US products and to promote and market them abroad with strategies that are oriented towards the long term.
Zandro, in the present, you know, you mentioned those phase one just now. What, if any, tensions have been eased with countries that previously imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods? And what are some of the difficulties that still remain there?
Yes, there are still a lot of difficulties ahead of U.S. producers. So following the U.S. removal of Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminum products from Canada and Mexico, both countries had officially lifted their retaliatory tariffs on agriculture and food products in May, June 2019. Our newest research shows that U.S. exports to Mexico recovered quickly after the announcement, but trade with Canada is still lagging far behind the pre-trade war figures. The Biden administration recently announced plans to review the phase one trade agreement that President Donald Trump forged with China in late 2019. Much of that deal was, bluntly said, a failure. Its centerpiece was China's pledge to buy about $200 billion of more U.S. goods and services split over 2020 and 2021. According to evidence from the deal's first year, meaning 2020, China was never on pace to meet that commitment, with the economic devastations of the COVID-19 pandemic only partially to blame. Attempting to manage trade to meet Trump's objective to reducing the bilateral trade deficit was self-defeating from the start. China actually did import more phase one goods from the United States in 2020 compared with the previous year. Imports were up by about 30%. However, US exports to China in 2019 were extraordinarily low, in part because China imposed retaliatory tariffs in response to Trump's trade war. US exports had declined 10% in 2018 compared with 2017, shrinking by another 8.5% in 2019. Therefore, the increase that we saw in comparison between 2019 and 2020 was a mere recovery, not even close to recovery, particular for agriculture and food products. So relatively to that precise legal commitment that the US and China agreed on in the phase one deal, China failed to meet the commitment spectacularly. It failed it by more than 40%.
Okay. Is there a reasoning why you think that they did fail? Was it just more them not really wanting to uphold an agreement with the US despite agreeing to it in the first place? Or do you think there's something more to it there?
Yes, there's politics to it. Phase one deal was a bilateral agreement, and obviously the Chinese government looked forward to the election to have something to negotiate on, basically. So due to the fact that the US election came up, the question was, should they even adhere to the deal? In addition, what you should keep in mind here is that U.S. exports to China, especially of agriculture and food products, were falling over the last 5 to 10 years already. So increasing the commitment significantly means that the supply and the demand has to be there somewhere to be met. And so the actual goals were very ambitious from the beginning compared to what is actually possible in terms of the US delivering to these markets.
Okay, thank you for that. Zandro, China was the heaviest hitter for retaliatory tariffs on US exports during that trade war. How did this affect the market share for food and ag products in China? And what do market shares look like today?
So the annual value of Chinese imports of seven major targeted commodities for California, which are almonds, pistachios, walnuts, grapes, oranges, sparkling wine, and wine, increased actually for the average of 2016-2017 compared to 2018-2019 from $439 million to $706 million. That is according to Chinese custom statistics. For instance, the annual average value of Chinese almond imports from the United States increased from $75 million to $160 million, and pistachios from $137 million to $394 million in 2018-2019 over 2016-2017. In contrast, the annual value of China's imports from the United States declined by 20% and 29% for wine and walnuts, respectively. Therefore, we believe that there was some degree of trade destruction actually taking place for targeted products, but this was countered by the substantial growth in China's pistachio imports from the United States. All products experienced a significant drop in market share, with the US market share for almonds dropping by more than 55% from 97.4% to 44%. This implies that lost trading opportunities amplified the trade destruction. Assuming average 2016-2017 market shares for 2019, Chinese imports from the United States could have been double their current 2019 level. So it means $1.5 billion instead of $707 million. Also, there is sufficient supply in the market. The US may have chosen not to meet all of the increased import demand in China.
Okay. What is the reasoning behind China imports of almonds being so much lower than pistachio? Pistachio going up, almonds going down.
So there was a significant degree of trade diversion taking place. Tariffs on both products were different, right? One faced higher tariffs than the other. And also the availability of different supplies in other markets was easier for walnuts than it was for pistachios. Therefore, it was, simply speaking, easier for importers of walnuts from China to switch out the US supplies and go for other markets.
Okay. All right, Zandro, we have time for one last question here. Multiple commodities in different states were compensated for losses in revenue associated with that trade war. Why were many commodities overcompensated, undercompensated, or not compensated at all?
So let me provide you some numbers for California. Tree nuts suffered losses of about $239 million, and the MFP payments were only about 52% of that loss, which is about $126 million. Similarly, dairy exports experienced loss of about $130 million, much more than the MFP compensation, which amounted to $70 million. Processed foods and vegetables experienced trade war losses, but they received no MFP payments. In contrast, we find that the US government actually overestimated the true impact of the trade war on fresh foods, rice, and cotton, and therefore overcompensated these commodities. For instance, the MFP 2 payments for cotton was about 40% of the market price, which was unwarranted in our view because we find a minimal loss for cotton as a result of the trade war. US exports of medium grain rice actually increased during the trade war, and California exports were steady at the same time. In our research, we find no evidence of any trade loss for California rice during the trade war period. The opposite is true. Californian rice producers exported significantly more to China during the trade war period than before the trade war. Which is interesting is here actually that California stands out as a relatively small recipient of farm payments in general, which is about 4% of the net farm income for California producers, and a very small recipient of MFP payments, 2% of the net farm income. In contrast, in a number of states, the MFP payments accounted for a very large share of the net farm income in 2018-2019. For instance, in Illinois, 52% of all the net farm income actually came from MFP payments. That's significant.
Yeah, that is significant. I wonder how some of this compensation actually works? Is this a matter of falsified statistics? How is the US government assuming that there are higher losses to these commodities than there actually are?
The US government in 2018 had to scramble, to be honest. Talking to people in the USDA, they had to scramble that. They had to figure out what are the potential losses that they're going to face. So particular for the first round of MFP payments, they had to find some evaluation based on pre-trade volumes to measure actually what could be the potential impact. The MFP2 payments were actually a lot better designed in terms of the ability to cover actual trade losses. So there was already a difference between MFP1 and MFP2. On the other hand, lobbyism and the ability of certain groups to influence policy played a major role. While there wasn't really an impact on California rice or rice producers in general, because there was no trade going on with China, for instance, California farmers still got a huge compensation actually for rice production. And that actually isn't really justified by any trade that took place in the pre-trade war period. The USDA, for instance, had to go back to 2012 to find any comparable number of California rice export to China to justify actually the payments that they made. And so politics plays here significantly into the decision-making of receiving payments.
Wow. Well, Zanjo, you've certainly shined a lot of light on this very complicated trade situation today. And we appreciate you doing that because a lot of people need to know what's going on here. It's very confusing and it really opens your eyes to kind of what happened during that trade war. So we appreciate you coming on today and chatting about that.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to share our research with your viewers today.
Of course. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
Here's your news brief for today from the California Farm Bureau. Potential thieves in rural California have been using drones to locate equipment and tools that they want to steal. The drones can scout property not visible from a public road. Authorities in Solano County report arresting two suspects in drone-related thefts, and other rural crime deputies describe similar situations. Deputies have warned farmers to keep valuable equipment out of sight from the air if possible, as well as locking it after use. How can we stem the tide of dairy operation bankruptcies and keep more dairy operators on their farms? Gary Crawford looks into the issue.
There are some really great, smart, hard-working dairy operators who have lost their dairies, gone out of business, or are in danger of it. Last year, over 2,500 U.S. dairies did go out of business, cutting the number of dairies by 7%, and that's been happening for several years now. Part of the problem? Milk production growing faster in some cases than demand. What can be done to help the dairy industry? Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says first, we need more exports of U.S. dairy products.
So that we can stabilize the price and make sure that farmers can stay in business.
But Vilsack told a House panel the other day,
I think it's also important that we create opportunities for those dairy farmers to have local and regional markets, the ability to negotiate their own price, if you will.
And so on that score,
we just announced over $300 million of support and help to local and regional food systems to try to create that alternative market.
Vilsack says there's also research going on by food and beverage companies.
And they're now looking for ways in which the ingredients within dairy can be segregated and utilized in a very high value way. Whey protein, huge protein source. Can we convert more of that into more nutritious sports drinks and snacks and things of that nature that creates additional market opportunities.
And finally, the push for ways to combat climate change and reduce emissions could provide what Vilsack enthusiastically calls a
tremendous opportunity for dairy. If you are essentially paying dairy for reducing methane or capturing methane and converting it into electricity and fuel, that's a new product. If you are creating opportunities for that manure that's being produced in the dairy operation to become an ingredient instead of going to the landfill or being overapplied on land and causing some issues, if it can be an ingredient in a new material, a new chemical, a new fabric, a new fiber, a new fuel source, we need to be doing much more of that creates another revenue stream for farmers.
All of this with one goal in mind:
keeping as many people on the farm as possible.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Wonderful Pistachios takes a fresh approach to snack marketing in a dedicated new campaign to bring its Wonderful Pistachios no-shells barbecue and sea salt and vinegar flavors to life. The highly tailored digital and social campaign is designed to reach consumers who love great flavors no matter their preferred online platform. Launching in May and running through the summer in the United States and Canada, the campaign features creative optimized for different mediums to authentically reach specific consumers. One of the most innovative platforms and a first for all Wonderful brands includes Twitch to help Wonderful Pistachios introduce the new No Shells flavor as a healthy and delicious snack for gaming. With 47 million U.S. adults being esports or electronic sports fans, according to a report by MRI Simmons, and more than 80% of esports fan reporting that they eat or drink while watching, the company says the convenience of pistachios without shells makes marathon gaming and snacking easy for esports fans. Gamers will also be reached through YouTube pre-roll and channels featuring gameplay content. How have increasing invasive feral swine populations impacted farmers across the country? Rod Bain reports.
A new YouTube video series produced in part by USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service gives a first-hand account of the scope of damage caused by invasive feral swine. APHIS's Janine Neske says this invasive pest continues to grow in population and spread in greater distance across the country.
They can eat and will eat just about anything. They will learn about a food resource and they will take full advantage of it.
So in the case of agriculture, stories of crop damage come from producers like Mississippi vegetable farmer Charlie Coleman.
When they root up the place and make these deep holes, it's impossible to plant that. You got to diss it up and smooth it down again and then plant.
From the cornfields.
You can have 20 acres gone in a night. So you're talking about thousands of dollars can be done in one night. And then once the corn gets up, you can ride in a turner and think it doesn't look that bad. But you can go 30 yards out in the field and there may be 30 acres mashed in the ground.
And the orchards, such as this from Oklahoma pecan grower Martin Mount.
The general costs for these hogs on my place are, one, loss of crop. It means I can't harvest it because there's big holes everywhere. The other cost that we incur is every spring I send somebody down and they spend 3 to 4 weeks down there smoothing out all the hog damage that they can find. That's a pretty big cost.
Go to Texas, cattle country, and the fear is the spread of disease from feral swine that could impact herds and business. This is Texas APHIS Wildlife Services Director Mike Bodenchuk.
While diseases can impact an individual ranch or rancher, the whole industry can be at risk. Trade issues are associated with disease-free status, and if we lose the disease-free status, trade can be shut down. The entire industry can be jeopardized by feral hog diseases.
Feral swine are omnivores, so APHIS's Janine Neske explains.
Anything that nests on the ground, so wild turkeys or quail, anything that they can get their mouth on, their snout around, they will consume.
And the burrowing nature of this invasive pest means damage to ag infrastructure. Examples provided by cattle rancher George Cook.
About how they tear the fences up, they just make big holes in there and just keep going. Get in a water trough, tear the floats up and everything else.
They broke that pipe here a while back, and then the pipe that goes from over there to over here, they broke it.
The video series can be found by going to YouTube and typing in the search bar, Feral Swine in America, USDA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty last week filed a lawsuit in a federal court challenging the alleged race discrimination in the American Rescue Plan. Specifically, the organization targets a provision to offer loan forgiveness based on racial categories. The organization filed the lawsuit Thursday on behalf of five plaintiffs from Wisconsin, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Ohio. The American Rescue Plan Act provides billions of dollars of debt relief to socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. But the law's definition of socially disadvantaged includes explicit racial classifications. Farmers and ranchers must be Black or African American, American Indian or Alaskan Native, Hispanic or Latino, or Asian American or Pacific Islander. Other farmers are ineligible for the program, according to the plaintiffs. The lawsuit alleges discrimination, calling the program illegal and unconstitutional. The lawsuit asks the court to issue an injunction and a declaratory judgment that the racial classifications in the Farmer Loan Forgiveness Program are unconstitutional. That's our news brief for today. Coming up next, the problems at the port. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Port congestion, empty shipping containers, ag products waiting too long for export. The California State Board of Food and Agriculture Tuesday discussed challenges and opportunities related to overall port congestion, with a special emphasis on agricultural exports. The board heard from port officials and agricultural stakeholders, as well as trucking, maritime, and retail industry representatives. Board President Don Cameron says, as the nation's largest agricultural exporter, California's farmers, ranchers, and food processors rely significantly on freight infrastructure. He says port congestion is not a new issue, but our current situation is amplified by the pandemic and its ripple effects within the overall marketplace. One of the speakers on the panel was Gene Sirocco with the California Association of Port Authorities and the Port of Los Angeles. Here are his opening remarks.
Contextually, the San Pedro Bay in Southern California houses the ports of Los Angeles and our neighbor port of Long Beach. This port complex accounts for 40% of our nation's imports and 30% of its exports. Specifically in Los Angeles, 1 in 9 jobs are accountable here based on the activities of the port in Southern California. That means 1 million paychecks every week rely on what we do here at this port. From dock workers to truck drivers, warehouse folks, administrators like myself, and many, many others. Los Angeles County, as you know, is still home to the largest manufacturing employee base in the nation of more than 390,000 individuals. In addition, the cargo that traverses this port of Los Angeles reaches each and every one of our nation's 435 congressional districts. This truly is a conversation of national significance. And not lost on us is how important our own backyard is. To tell you a little bit about how we got here, it's been about 3.5 years of trade impact and disruption. First, based on the policies of the previous administration in Washington with relation to trade, the tariffs that were implemented in March of 2018, the retaliatory tariffs mainly by China, and the impact it's had on a myriad of industries here in the United States. That ill-advised policy has created choppiness in the supply chain of folks rushing imports to the United States under tariff milestone dates and having below market prices based on phase 1 trade deals with China and other mechanisms that have been very bad for the American farmer. We've also seen manufacturing shifts away from China, cargo moving to Southeast and South Asia, elongating transit times, creating different paths, and taking cargo away from the state of California. Imports have continued to surge while exports have declined here at the nation's largest port, 26 of the last 29 months. And in today's statements by the Department of Commerce, the trade gap that the United States holds now has even widened further by $74 billion U.S. dollars, and the trade gap with China has increased by $37 billion U.S. dollars. We have seen since the pandemic began a shift away from services to commoditized goods. If you can remember back about a year ago in January, the central government in China effectively required everyone to stay at home, shuttering our manufacturing industry in China. Not too long after that, in March, we here in the United States went through nearly the same series of episodes, and the stay-at-home orders and everything else in our economy basically grinding to a halt. From there, we shifted and pivoted very quickly from a personal consumption based on services to one based on the purchase of goods. And in fact, this pandemic-induced buying surge has created a level of importation that we have never seen before. The cargo volume on the import side continues to rush through at record-breaking numbers, but stalling many of the intricate processes and participants in the supply chain. And as we have continued as American consumers to buy tangible retail goods, think of the big box retailers, home improvement stores, our neighborhood hardware store that stayed open during the pandemic and the shutdown orders, we were not spending discretionary income on flying to go see our grandparents, going to the movies, attending ball games, or anything in the service sector. That has really changed the way the American economy looks, and it's changed the shipping industry dramatically. Over the past 9 months, those record-breaking volumes have been one way in trade. A massive deluge of imports and very little to show on the export side of the business. Yet the numbers in totality are in double-digit form growth over 2019, a more stable year during the first 6 months. As loaded exports have gone down, as the trending shows on the left side of your screen, the reposition of empty containers has continued to increase. So we've got three things that face us for the exporter in America today. Number one is the trade policy that continues to linger and hamper us. Number two is our fiscal or monetary policy, where many people believe that a strong US dollar bodes well for America. It makes it very challenging for us and our exporters to compete with other trading nations in sales to our primary catchment area in Asia. And thirdly, the unique perspective that liner shipping companies have taken since this import surge in the summer of 2020 to expedite empty containers back to Asia to pre-position these assets and get ready for the next round of imports. So we can say there has been a focus on that cycle of containers moving back and forth across the Pacific. As a landlord port here in Los Angeles and with the construct of the California Tidelands Trust, we don't control the containers, we don't control the shipping lines, the trucks, or the railroads, but we have assembled a team and exhibit outsized responsibility to work with industry and find common solutions. One, as we spoke to Secretary Ross recently, was to convene parties of interest and those who have been affected by these changes during COVID-19 and our changes in the economics of round-trip transportation. I'm very pleased to participate today and thankful that you've assembled a number of people throughout your meeting that can comment on their segment of the industry and how hopefully at the culmination of this meeting, one of the suggestions I would bring forth is that we have regular convenings of parties to make sure that we are attuned to our common customer, the California agriculture customer. Now, as we look a little bit deeper into the numbers, I will tell you that we are the only port in the United States with what we call a port community system. It gives us the best data now, today, historically, and how we can place ourselves from a competitiveness standpoint in the future. What you're looking at are all agricultural exports through California ports, 2019 versus 2020. And we've basically held our own in total volume. That's not really good enough in today's marketplace. Next page. Looking at the breakdowns, you'll see a declination in the oils and seeds, but other market segments showing increase. Again, we'd like to see all of these areas continue to earn year-on-year growth and help connect our California agriculture community with their overseas customers. All of this time, there have been widespread media reports of port congestion and caused effects. One is skilled labor. And this chart reports to you that we have done a pretty good job as a community making sure a skilled labor is out on the docks to move all the cargo and containers that are traversing our port today. We have no shortage of labor. We have no shortage of skilled labor. Like many other industries, we were hit very hard in January by COVID-19 illness. It affected about 5 to 6% of our workforce, yet we still had ample reserves to manage the cargo that was coming through. And we also took the opportunity, with the great support of the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of agriculture, and GoBiz, to vaccinate a working majority of our longshore men and women so they could stay out on the docks on a regular basis. These men and women are averaging 5.5 days of work per week since the pandemic began. What I'm showing you now on the screen is a picture of the number of ships at anchor outside the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. Due to this deluge of cargo coming in, ships cannot get into port and work quickly enough. Today, as an example, we have 14 container vessels in port. Pre-surge or pre-pandemic, we would average 10 vessels working in port every day. Since the surge began last summer, we're averaging 15 vessels working every day. Our vessel productivity, thanks to the marine terminal operators, longshore men and women, is up 50% year on year. But we still can't handle all of this cargo coming in because we're codependent with so many other nodes of the system. At anchor today, we have 19 container vessels. That's less than half of the peak we saw in February, just 7 weeks ago. And we continue to be on a downward trend of cleaning up the backlog and bringing more ships into port. The screen I'm now showing you is a look at the top, what our terminals looked like a year ago in April. And as you can see, they were quite empty. The bottom was taken just yesterday from drone footage by Los Angeles Port Police, showing the sheer volume of cargo that's at our terminals today. Marine terminals operate at full capacity when 80% of their property is filled with containers. Since the import surge began, we've been operating well in excess of 100% capacity, with containers lining up between 90 and 95% of available property. Think of it like going to the mall or the shop or the supermarket. When folks start parking in the driveways, when all the slots are filled, that's what the marine terminals look like right now. And it means little maneuverability to get containers in and out of those gates. We're working with 50 vessel gangs today of longshore labor, men and women. No gangs have been cut, but on average, because of the minimal maneuverability we have on terminals, we have an excess of about 10% of labor right now. So all of this means, this graph shows how all these anchored vessels built up into the month of February and are now starting to deplete. This is a chain reaction of events. Retailers ordering a tremendous amount of goods. You and I buying more goods than ever. In fact, online purchases doubled in 11 months and grew faster than it took the 10 previous years to accomplish on the national retail scale. Our warehouses from the Pacific to the Mojave Desert, more than 2 billion square feet of warehousing and distribution space, are overflowing with import goods. The next container that comes in looking for warehouse space sits. The container on the terminal also rests longer than normal. The ship takes longer to work, more than double the time it did pre-pandemic, and ships now wait at anchor. The demand for empties to get back to Asia for these high-priced imports have been the focus of liner shipping companies. to swallow up all that demand that has been coming for the last 9 months. All of this in real numbers are very important as well. The average time a ship sits at anchor now for the month of April is 6.7 days. While it's down, it needs to be zero. The days after discharge, how long a container sits in a terminal before it moves, is now 3.9 days, down from a high of 5. We're getting some traction. Our importers on occasion have been using these marine terminals as warehousing space because all of our other proper facilities are full. There's also liberal use of free time that does not necessarily equate to expedient movement of containers. That's an industry issue that must be addressed. Street dwell time, or those containers waiting for space at our warehouses, is now at 6.5 days, almost double what it was previously before the surge, and has a direct impact on the number of chassis that must be supplied into the pool of pools to move all these containers in and out of the port. Also in the news recently, the rail dwell time, currently sitting at 7.5 days, is down from 11 days in the month of March, but normal times would see a rail dwell of 2 days, meaning containers sitting waiting for rail departure sit now for 7.5 days. The Western Railroads and our short line PHL are working around the clock to get assets, engine power, and crew here to the Southern California Basin. But when a ship departs now after completing its work, we have another following right behind it within hours. There is no breathing room for these service providers to get the cargo moving. Now on to the solutions. I mentioned that we have the nation's only port community system. Its concept was to share information built off the congestion that we witnessed at these ports on the West Coast in the wintertime of 2014 and 15. Sharing information early on so folks know how to staff, what assets are needed, and how they need to prepare is the entire game here. This is a subject of much criticism, but what I can tell you is that this system has been invested fully by the Port of Los Angeles and is free for port partners and stakeholders. It can help adjust cargo volumes, turn times on trucks, understanding how much cargo is coming in, where to prepare, and how to return empty containers to the port complex that truckers were struggling so much with. In addition to the signal and return signal that were rolled out in the fall, the control tower was rolled out in February to give an overall view of port activity, including transit times of trucks, bottlenecks, and how to avoid them. More of this can be used in the agriculture community to find out where empty containers are, how quickly they can be turned for loading, and brought back for proper ship assignments for export to Asia and beyond. And even though we are a landlord port, not controlling any of the other pieces, but working very closely with our partners here at the port complex, we laid out 3 specific items to effectively eliminate port congestion. Number one was we needed to vaccinate our workers. We still have a lot to do with our port truck drivers, warehouse folks, and others who are less organized than longshore labor. We need to continue to increase the cargo velocity on imports. Simply put, pick up your cargo. Get those containers freed up so we can start having that dialogue about utilizing them for export. And clearing the backlog. We've reduced that ship anchorage number by more than half. In fact, yesterday it was down by 2/3. We'll continue to chip away at that. In the intermediate term, we need a better program for chassis, truck gates. We need to move 60,000 trucks per day. And with the federally mandated hours of service, we tend to scrunch everything to the middle, and we're not operating efficiently around the clock. In fact, on our nightside operations, we still have 30% of truck appointments that go to no-show. We've got to do a better job giving the trucking community confidence that they will be serviced and showing those opportunities to eager exporters so we can get their cargo moving. And lastly, it's all about long-term competitiveness for us as a state and a port. We've got to get it right when it comes to operations. We must be very careful of our finances, delivering value for the transactional costs that our customers face. And we must have state policy that encourages business to come here, while using that as a delicate balancing act with our world-leading environmental stewardship and the necessary protections for our companies and employees.
We continue with the meeting on ports right after this.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Continuing our reporting of the California State Board of Food and Agriculture meeting discussing problems at the ports, Mike Jacob with the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association gave short opening remarks with his takes on the current issues.
It's hard to follow Gene's presentations because they're so good, really appreciate him and Weston participating in the panel today too. They really provide you guys with a wealth of different knowledge from different points of view within our sector. But even though, as Gene pointed out, we all have different roles and we fill different niches in the supply chain. With respect to policy and development of moving forward, we really all do sit in the same position, and we're really glad to be with you today to talk about the importance of maintaining California exports, but more broadly to facilitate competitiveness in California trade, as Gene was talking about, as a long-term policy goal. The state of California has been really well positioned, especially in the last several years after Governor Brown launched his sustainable freight program, BDFA, GoBiz, Air Resources Board, Natural Resources Agency, Caltrans have all been partners in that. And we thank this agency and other agencies for participating in that as well. I don't have a separate presentation today, but to build on what Gene had already laid out pretty comprehensively, I think it's worth saying a few things, and then I'm available for questions when we get to the panel discussion. I think that's probably the most important part of today is to be responsive to your questions about what's happening. And so really happy to be here today to do that. On one of Gene's panels and his graph about the amount of volume that's going through the Port of LA, you might have noticed and not be surprised to know the sharp drop off from March of 2020 last year, which we all understand. What he didn't point out was the phenomenal number, I think, on that same chart, which was there's over 120% greater volume this March than last March due to the surge that he was explaining. So with the leadership of port, but also from our members, we represent ocean carriers, marine terminal operators, the help of our partners, both on the motor carrier and rail carrier side, that's a tremendous whiplash. We described it earlier in some communications to our membership as a tsunami. You have a quick withdrawal from the shore, and then it's followed by a wave crashing upon you that you weren't prepared for. And that's essentially what's happened to our supply chain. We built these intermodal networks internationally around just-in-time delivery. We have built supply chains that are really resilient because they are flexible. But that flexibility breaks when you've run out of equipment, or it's not in the right place, it's positioned poorly, or your nodes can't handle the capacity. And we have experienced all of those things right now. I think the fair thing to say is that it's almost impossible to plan for these types of things. They are not conducive to long-term policy discussions. They stray into the land of bad facts make bad law, we really look at these things as a one-off. But in the midst of all that, I do want to say that one of the things that Gene's presentation also highlighted was the amount of additional capacity that can be brought to bear in a short amount of time through mustering of labor, through mustering of resources, and through an expansion of our accessibility to warehousing space and being flexible. So to the extent that again, we're here to start a discussion, we're very happy to have been invited today. We can talk about some specifics, but I do want to say ahead of time one more thing, which is we are very aware of the fact that we have people in the import and particularly in the export world right now that are very frustrated with our level of service. And obviously we have reasons for that, those are what they are. They're not meant to be excuses, but we are, as an industry, we are not performing at the same level of service that you might have expected pre-pandemic, and that's just a fact. In the course of that business you're doing with our industry, if at any point you feel like things have not gone appropriately or you are being treated unfairly, there are mechanisms for complaints, and you should utilize those with your carrier. That's not just for ocean carriers, that's motor carriers, rail carriers. We all have a lot of challenges, but we need to hear from our customers. We need to work with customers. To the extent you're frustrated by those things, we encourage you to work directly with your carriers. In the event that those complaints don't work out, obviously, we can talk a little bit more on this call about what's happening in other forum and where issues have bubbled up to the Federal Maritime Commission if that's necessary. But in the meantime, our mantra is we all are on the same page. We all are on the same team. We want to move as much cargo as possible. We want to encourage the export of as much cargo as possible and facilitate that in the long run by adopting policies that make sense and that make California competitive. Thanks for having us today.
Weston Labar with the Harbor Trucking Association also gave brief remarks and talked about a recent California law that is making things even harder.
I think, Cameron, if I could just take 2 quick minutes from the Harbor Trucking Association's perspective, and thank you for inviting us. We truckers just appreciate being invited to have a seat at the table, because historically that wasn't always the case. But, you know, for me, I think this is a little bit of a call to action for you all as well, because you guys have a big voice and we need a lot of help. We've boiled this down to 4 major things that we think we need to look at to improve congestion, not just today, but moving forward long term. And these are things that Gene and Mike and other stakeholders and ourselves have been part of. But we're starting to see what happens when you have a prolonged peak. It creates a disruption in service. And so the 4 major things we've looked at, and Gene touched on a little bit of this, but policy reform, and whether those are industry reforms like things like free time or detention and demurrage to make sure that they operate within how the construct of operations work today. We need to take a look at that. But I think more broadly, your advocacy voice or policy from the federal, state, and local level. Federal policy with trade and tariffs has disrupted trade lanes and has made it more difficult to get exports out of the country. We need to change that. Those tariffs need to be looked at in a way that don't hurt American exporters. And unfortunately, I think that's been the byproduct of a tough on China stance. Secondly, you look at statewide, We have what were progressive environmental and labor policies that are becoming draconian environmental and labor policies that are scaring truckers out of the market, scaring companies away from growth. Quite frankly, we need capacity. And at the federal level, again, we're trying to procure equipment. And the ITC came down with a ruling that will make it impossible to buy new chassis until Q3 or Q4 of this year. And most production won't happen until 2022. So how do you solve an equipment shortage issue when you're told that you can't import a chassis from a Chinese manufacturer or import the steel, which they all rely on to make an American chassis? It's incongruent with trade policy. It's incongruent with our supply chain goals. But again, looked at in a vacuum, it was done to help prop up an American manufacturing industry that we're all going to lose out on in the short term because there's no true transition policy. And we need to look at local policies. We've tried to work with municipalities on things like temporary off-dock container yards, different ways to make the supply chain work more efficiently. And the fact of the matter is that every city you talk to doesn't want a truck or a warehouse in their city. And it makes it very difficult for us to move product if we have nowhere to take it off port and create space for exports to get there, or if we have no place to stage exports so we can meet the ship departure times. And these are the facts that we're dealing with on a policy side. Gene touched on it, and the Port of LA has been a great, great leader in investing in digital infrastructure. But we need to understand that vertical integration is not a solution, but virtual integration is. And what we should all be doing through our RFP processes and through our investments are upgrading our commercial systems and making our partners integrate with us so we can provide better data to folks like Gene and work as if we're one supply chain for you, the shipper. And then as part of that policy discussion, the inland infrastructure needs to support the port growth. We can't move something if we have nowhere to take it, and we can't move something to the port if we don't have a place to stage it. And unfortunately, again, our local cities and municipalities are not on the same page with our port authorities, even the cities that manage and trust for the state of California, those port authorities. And finally, and quickly, is our workforce. They are the backbone of our industry. And quite frankly, you know, you see rising costs, but from the trucking side, it's because we need to attract more people to our industry, and we need to make sure those folks are fairly compensated and they have consistency. And I think that in general, trucking has been looked at as a low price commodity in the equation, when in actuality, we're a high value service partner. And we need to be looked at that way, and to be able to create reliability and certainty in the trucking portion of the supply chain, we need to make sure that we're properly investing in both assets and people.
We will continue coverage of this meeting in tomorrow's program. That is our show for today. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.